8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
That time.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AT2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Met. The Limark Technical Met has been going strong since 1982, and it continues to this day. And as always, I like to remind people of a few bits and pieces of paperwork. If you have any questions and you cannot communicate on the radio, you can communicate via email. We have a mailbag email address for any questions, or if you have any topics you would like to hear covered, or if you have any puzzles. We often intermix puzzles of a scientific nature into our technical net. So if you have any of that, or if you would like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a website or a story or a video, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And we have links to some interesting articles already, and if I pull other articles out later today, I will put them in the links. Right now, there are two links. A very interesting article about the IEEE, article about the uncertainty of the future of ham radio, and there's a very interesting article about the COVID virus and one of the methods that it's using to hijack cells. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, in addition, I am hopefully streaming this audio on the internet, so if you have some friends who do not have access to other sources of IRLP and other sources of audio streaming, you can tell them to just type into their browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that should give you the audio stream. And unfortunately, Echo Link seems to be down tonight. IRLP is up and operating. That's good, but Echo Link seems to be down. So you can tell them to just type into their browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you give them an audio stream for the technical net for the rest of the night. And the archives are available. Mike, AC2NJI, has a website called amateurradio.tv, in which he has archived technical net episodes going all the way back to September of 2006. So if you're curious or interested and want to be entertained and informed and educated, you can listen to great guys who came before me, Mel, K2KEY, of course, Dick, K2RIW. The wisdom that they offered is still available on that website, amateurradio.tv. So, I will let it drop, and then we will begin the technical net. I have a mailbag sort of question. It's not exactly a technical question, but it's ham radio related. And someone else emailed me that he would like to discuss something about COVID-19 later on tonight. So, hopefully we'll have some activity, some participation among people listening. I will drop it, and then I will come back and ask for participants.
NY2H, Echo Link seems to be up.
Yeah, the interlink is up, but the Echo Link is down, at least for me.
Oh, I'll give you a call on it right now.
NY2H, on it. Okay, Lou, I hear you. So it's going in at least that direction. I cannot connect to W2VLR times out. So I don't know why I'm having problems, but maybe it's just local here.
Yeah, it's working both directions.
Okay, when I get a chance, I'll fidget around with it and see if there's a setting that I need to change. It was kind of working fine before, but right now it says not in QSO, cannot connect to W2VLR. But, you know, hopefully other people aren't having that problem. Thank you very much. So once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. And if you have any questions or topics that you would like to discuss of a technical nature, please give me your call sign and your first name.
K2TGW, Les.
Okay, Les recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list tonight?
K2 Bravo Zulu, Rich.
Rich recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list tonight?
B2GB, Craig, yes.
Okay, Craig, you're on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list tonight? Okay, we'll start off with Les, K2TGW. What's your question or your topic tonight?
I have an MFJ, a small size loop antenna tuner. My question is, would it make a difference what gauge wire I use for my loop? Right now I have some very heavy wire. I figured that would be better for a little more broadbandedness. But would it make any difference if it was a simple bell wire? Back to you.
Well, the important part about magnetic loops is the insertion loss. You want to have the lowest resistance humanly possible. So that's kind of why it's sort of important. You're not going to get that much of a lower Q and a higher bandwidth by increasing, say, the diameter of the loop itself, because magnetic loops just have such a high Q to begin with. But you want it to be the most efficient design that you can. So, you know, for the money, the time, and the expense, you want the insertion loss to be the least possible. So I wouldn't be as concerned, say, with the outer diameter dimensions for the sake of decreasing your Q and increasing your bandwidth. I would be more focused on making sure that the total resistance of the loop would be as low as you could possibly make it.
Okay, I was just trying to kill two birds with one stone. I mean, it works. You go about 2 megacycles or 3 megacycles other side what you've got it set for, it's not happy. But okay, it's not a problem. I expect to use it outside with some low power radio and put this on top of the grill, and while I sit in the shade with some little itty bitty toy putting out between 5 and 10 watts. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome, Les. Magnetic loops are loads of fun. I have one in my backyard. They have a lot of benefits. They're small, they're compact, they're not really, they don't need the height that the many antennas do. Dipoles really should be at least a half a wavelength above ground, and you can get away with 7, 8, 9, 10 feet above ground for a loop. But no matter what you do with a loop, it's still going to have a very high Q. You know, fundamentally, some people think of it as this magical thing that only intercepts magnetic waves as opposed to electromagnetic waves. But it's really just a shortened dipole with interesting characteristics. So you're always going to have those high Qs. And unless you stick to the same frequency, you're doomed to have to retune the antenna if you change frequency. That's the universe doesn't give you a free lunch. It gives you with one hand and takes away with the other.
Oh, how true. All right, get to the next guy with a good problem. K2TGW will be clear and listening.
Okay, Les. On to Rich, W2BZ. What's your question or topic for tonight, Rich?
Well, surprise, surprise, it has to do with DMR. As some of you know, or too many of you know, I've taken a dive off the high board into DMR, and it's been quite a journey. I've gotten to the point now where I can program a code plug, no problem. I can get a radio to work, no problem. But what I haven't been able to do is understand the relationship between the different aspects of what goes into a code plug. let me drop a second. For instance, we have digital contacts, we have talk group lists, we have zones, we have channels, and what else do we have here? Couple. And I'm just wondering why these need to be so separated. What am I missing? Can any of these categories be combined at all so you don't need five categories just to operate a radio? I know it wasn't made for ham radio, I know all that, but it just seems like nobody's explained, and I've tried to find a good explanation for how and why these things work together. Back to net.
AC2GS. Okay. Basically, the format of DMR is two levels of hierarchy. On the top is a thing called a zone. You can have many zones in a radio. It's only limited by the memory and the operating system software. So zones are collections of channels. That's the second level from the hierarchy. So you have zones. Zones go into channels. Channels, within channels, is the definition for all the other quantities and qualities. Because it is primarily designed as a means of communication of RF, primarily, you have the things that are very specific to DMR. Time slots. DMR uses time domain multiplexing. So every 30 milliseconds, it switches between two packets of two separate conversations. So you have to tell it if you want slot one or you want slot two. It's just the requirement of TDMA technology. Another very similar to private line or PL tone is something called color codes. There are a series of values for color codes that define a certain repeater so that you can transmit with two repeater having the exact same frequencies, but if the color codes are different, the one with the wrong color code is not going to respond to your transmission. So you need the time slot and the color code and, of course, the frequency to talk to the repeater. In addition to that, if you just want to talk to the local repeater, you don't really have to worry too much. The problem becomes when you want to talk to a network attached to that repeater. They're attached through a whole series of different ways. DMR has something called a C-bridge. That links the different talk groups. And the way that everyone's decided to get to use the talk group is to use the talk group's ID number as a unique identifier. Ordinarily, if you wanted to talk to Joe Schmo on a given repeater, and Joe Schmo's ID was 666666666, you would put that the contact list would be Joe's ID and only Joe's ID. And when you keyed up, it would only break squelch with Joe's radio, and otherwise no one else would hear you. Well, you use the same method by using the ID for a given talk group. If you want to talk to Tactical 310, its ID number is 310. You put in the contact list public ID of 310, and when you hit the push-to-talk button, your packet includes that information. It hits
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Okay. Unfortunately, I think I waxed too poetic there. How much did I get to before it timed out on me?
We're up to talk room.
Okay, hopefully this is where I lost the repeater. The way that you engage a talk group is the same way that you engage an individual. If you're talking to Joe Schmo with an ID number of 666666, you put that in your contact information as a private ID for that channel, and when you key down on that channel, you're talking to Joe, and only Joe. It doesn't break anyone else's squelch. Just like that, if you wanted to talk instead of to Joe, to everyone listening in to TAC 310, TAC 310's ID is 310, you would use the public ID of 310, which is the same as a talk group, and that would tell the repeater that in your packet you wanted it to switch in TAC 310 on their network connection through the Internet. So you need all those pieces. You can arrange them in different places sometimes. You can't really do that with zone and channels. Channels kind of contains all the information other than zones, and zones is just a way of consolidating lists of channels.
Okay, so the way I see it, zones is very simple to understand. You could have 20 zones or 16 zones, each with 16 talk groups in them. I see it as a way of splitting up like a file cabinet. I see that. I also understand channels. Channels is where the meat, so to speak, is with time slots and frequency and all the information that's needed for that channel. The talk group contains a unique identifier, which leaves now digital contacts. Where does digital contacts fit into this scheme?
Usually, a different CPS software. CPS software, for those who don't know, is the kind of generic phone plug writing software. You plug in your so-called phone plug into a piece of software for either your PC or your Mac, and it decodes the data package into a readable form, and you manipulate it, and then you save it as a code plug, and you upload the code plug to the handy-talkie or your other DMR type of radio. Sometimes it's called digital ID, but sometimes it's also called contact ID. So they kind of get soft and mushy around the edges. There are receiver IDs, and there are contact or transmission IDs. And it's either transmission or contact IDs that are the definitive entry. If you list something in your contact ID, it kind of basically means that you want it on your transmit ID and your receive ID. Because, you know, why would you want to talk to a talk group and not hear what they say back at you?
Okay, well, the digital contacts or whatever else they call them, could that not be incorporated, let's say, into the channels, for instance?
Okay, I think what you're asking is there's a different section in CPS that just is a list of contacts, of IDs. And it's just a very sparse data matrix where it has unique identifying numbers and then a text file that describes them. The way that CPS has decided to do this is to have a centrally located database that maintains these contact lists. So it wants it to be in the right place. You pull them into the channel information. You can't, the channel sections to enter to a great degree have very few actual open text fields. They are usually slide outs that are based on data files that you've entered in other portions of the CPS. So it's sort of just the way the designers have decided to make almost every CPS that's DMR that I'm aware of, that you enter the database in a different list along digital contacts, and then you pull them into the channel definition by opening a window and selecting your pre-entered database that you put into the digital contact entry.
And if one piece of these four things, the zones, the channels, the talk groups, the digital contacts, if one piece of data is missing, the whole thing doesn't work. Is that correct?
Well, to a degree, yes, because it's just the way hierarchies, unfortunately, work.
In order to get to a channel, you have to predetermine a zone and put that channel into the zone. There's no way that DMR radios that I'm aware of can access a channel without it being in a zone. So there's usually a knob that selects for the zone, and then there's a knob that selects for one of the channels within the zone. So if you don't have a zone, you can't go anywhere. If you don't have a channel, obviously, you can't get anywhere. As far as the other values, obviously, if you don't have the right frequency, the right time slot, the right color code, you can't access the remote, repeater. And in addition, if you don't have the contact list, if you don't have the ID, then it doesn't know who you want to talk to. So if you just want to talk to the local repeater and just hear the guys there and not trigger a talk group, it'll work. But in order for it to be fully functional, the only way for the repeater to know what talk group you want to talk on is to include that information in your channel database. So you sort of need all this information, and if you miss any of it, it doesn't work. It's sort of like your address. If you miss a couple of letters of it, chances are they won't know where you're from.
Digital contacts actually key up which talk group that you want to talk to. And by the way, this is all going RF into a repeater, right? Into a digital repeater. This has nothing to do yet with hotspots.
Yes, because primarily when everyone was trying to figure out how to make everything run, they were not thinking about hotspots because they didn't exist. Hotspots adds a little bit of a nuance to the whole thing, but the underlying principle is still similar. You just consider it as though your hotspot is just another repeater that you're communicating with through RF, which is the way that it works through RF. It happens to have its own internet interface, but then so do your repeaters out there. That's how they get onto their network. So, you know, you just treat your hotspot as your own personal repeater, and the principle is pretty much the same.
Believe it or not, I think you've cleared up a lot of it. The one thing that I can't understand is why, if a channel isn't in a zone, is it a channel that has to be in the zone, or is it a talk group that has to be in the zone? That's not going to work. Why does it have to be in a zone?
It's like you've decided that you're going to keep all the important things that you own paper-wise in a filing cabinet. And your filing cabinet has five drawers. And for some odd reason, you've taken a piece of paper and you've put it behind your filing cabinet. So it's not in the five drawers. So unless you remember that that's where you put it, you're not going to find it in your file cabinet, will you?
I guess you wouldn't. Besides these four things, the zones, the channels, the talk groups with the unique identifiers, and the digital contact, is there anything on top of that needed to make this work, or is that just about it, Roy?
AC2GS. Well, thankfully, that's pretty much all there is. Now, when you're dealing with, and we've talked in the past, if you're dealing with hotspots, there are sometimes little tricks that the guy who designed the hotspot to put into the software so that if you send strange talk group signals out, instead of connecting to that talk group, it will carry out different instructions with the one spot, open spot. There are designations, ID designations, that do not transmit through the internet, but simply change what the basic file is that runs the open spot. So you can have a setup for different types of open spot configurations, and you can have, I think there's six different options. So you can switch between six complete different programs that set up the open spot. And I'm sure PiStar has similar things. So there are more complications higher up if you want to do magic tricks. with your hotspot. But that's about it for as far as repeaters are concerned.
There was somebody else calling in. Go ahead, caller.
WB2KWC, I'd like to comment on channels.
Yeah, sure can.
Okay, thank you. I always thought of the digital IDs or the digital contacts as kind of your calls. And the channels basically tell you what you need to do to talk to that particular call letter, we'll call it, on a radio. I mean, to me, channels are like, you know, the digital contact is, let's say, right, AC2GS. A channel applies RF information. So I would need a channel for Roy AC2GS on W2VL. I would need a channel for Roy AC2GS on WB2NHO. And let's say a third channel, which would be Roy AC2GS on 20 meters. Basically, that's the radio information. AC2GS, WB2KWC.
NY2H with a comment.
Okay, one sec, Lou. I just want to mention, just to further complicate matters, and if you wanted to, you can put all those channels together into a zone called Roy. So that would be the hierarchy for that. Yes, Lou, you wanted to say something.
All righty. I think if we step back a little bit and take a philosophical bent here, it may help Rich. Rich is looking at this and wondering who the heck put this together, and it seems so convoluted when it could be so simple. However, he has to understand that this was originally done commercially. It was done primarily for fleet organizations and public service organizations where they had certain hierarchies in their organizational chart. And they wanted to map in a technology of communications to support that. Us as amateur operators adopted it. It allowed us to buy equipment that came off commercial, etc. But it wasn't designed for amateur radio initially. So it's a protocol. It's agreed upon by committee, and this is what they came up with. So that is why you're looking at something that looks a little convoluted, but in the other world probably makes a lot of sense. Back to Ned.
Okay, very good, Lou. Yeah, I've kind of mentioned bits and pieces of that through the last few months. You know, one of the things that sort of confused the newbie type of guy is he's not quite sure what these ID numbers are all about, you know, because if you go to something like D-Star, or if you go to Fusion, which is much more designed with the amateur in mind, you enter your call sign directly into the software, and it goes off because the packet design is amenable to an identifier that could be a person's call sign. With DMR, the identifier cannot be letters and numbers. It has to be a series of numbers. And then you need a lookup table to figure out who's who. DMR Mark stepped up and did that. Now I think it's radioid.com that has the database for that. And so there's a lot of legacy issues. The one shining thing about DMR is that it's a relatively inexpensive mode versus D-Star and Fusion. And us hams really like to save a couple of bucks. So that's why we endure code plugs and all these philosophical problems that we have.
GDC. By the way, I bought a Radiodity GD77 because there's a guy out there who has so modified the firmware to make it not only easier to use, but more efficient, logical, I guess that is easier to use, and added features, for instance, where you can turn a GD77 into a hotspot. It's actually, you could make the radio a hotspot, and you still need the Raspberry Pi, but you do away with the NV, DMV, whatever it is, the hat part of it, and turn it into a hotspot. And it keeps on developing the thing, you know, like every week there's something new. And I finally understood, you know, I studied this system and finally understood it. And it's pretty amazing what this one guy, he has a team of about four helpers, but this one guy from Australia has done. Anyway, Roy, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Rich. I wish you good luck with the GT77. It sounds like a very interesting device, and hopefully you'll come back and tell me about all the tricks you've got for it to do. So thanks, Rich, and good luck. Okay, next on our list is Craig, KD2OGB. What's your question or topic tonight, Craig?
KD2OGB and the TechNet. Thank you, Roy. Lou and I had this topic a couple of weeks ago, and I'd like your opinion on it, because I'd like to bring it up to a couple of friends of mine. A repeater out in Southold that I sometimes use when I'm out in Riverhead, W2AMC, 440050, it reaches pretty far out in the North Shore, and I've hit it as far as Shirley. Now, when I'm on Selden, usually I can hit it as far as Matatuck unless I'm operating full power. Lou had a good suggestion. If that repeater is very quiet and somehow the club that runs the repeater, is there actually any restrictions or any ways to have a repeater from another club be used for our club as well, like sharing?
Well, if you get the approval of the repeater control operator, yes, you can. And to a degree, that's sort of what we do with Selden and Glen Oaks. So we have links that connect the two of them, and they repeat each other. It's always good practice to ask pretty please. I mean, to a degree, that's somewhat what goes on with IRLP. John, KC2SHO, is out there in Los Alamos, and he connects to us through IRLP. We have Canadian repeaters and a California repeater that links itself temporarily through IRLP, and it acts as a linked repeater until they terminate the link. So as long as you have the approval and the method, yes, you can link repeaters. There's nothing illegal about it.
A friend of mine, also known as our museum president, Don, NTQHV, I would like to bring this topic up to him. And also another friend of his, Charles, KQGLP, they run these two repeaters for Peconic Amateur Radio Club.
Okay, I mean, I would also discuss it with Richie, K2KNB, because, you know, although it would be a generous offer to for them to allow linkage, you want to secure that the club is interested in a similar configuration.
Yeah, I'll definitely bring it up. I want to first see what Don's opinion is, and then I'll bring it up with Richie, because as far as Selden, I can hit it just fine out in Matatuck, but it gets pretty faint when I'm farther out there. But with the UHF machine out there in Southold, it would work perfectly between Selden and Southold as long as there's a line of sight for the two repeaters to link well. So I'll see maybe what I can do. On my next visit to the Railroad Museum, I will definitely bring this up with Don.
Okay, very good, Craig. And, you know, I mean, we talk, Rich and I often talk, W2BZ, about DMR and talk groups and rooms and reflectors. But before there were any of those, there was IRLP, which is an Internet-based, a voice-over Internet protocol linkage between other repeaters. And, you know, if you ever have nothing better to do, Google IRLP and take a look through at the specs. And there are these pages upon pages of information available. So it certainly is possible, and as long as it's not a a shotgun marriage, that the two people and the two repeaters are amenable to linking either part-time or full-time, the more the merry.
Okay, I will definitely look into that. That is all I have for now. Thank you very much, Roy. ACTGS, net control, KD2OGB, carry on.
Okay, once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limar Technical Net. So if anyone has any questions of a technical nature or topics that they would like to discuss tonight, please give me your call sign and your first name. Okay, unfortunately, someone started to identify themselves. I got the W, and then there were a bunch of tones after that. So if you could please give me your call sign again.
Okay, it is WB2KW3.
Oh, Ken, sure. What's your question for tonight, or topic?
Okay, the discussion on DMR kind of got me thinking. What is the difference between a group call and a private call? Is it simply convention? Like, you know, we have repeater inputs are on one set of frequencies, repeater outputs are on another set of frequencies. Or is there actually something different in the radio signal produced by a group call versus a private call?
Well, it's a good question. There are identifiers on CPS to differentiate once you've entered a talk group, a ID, whether it's private or public. So they might include that flag as part of the packet. I am not quite sure, though, if the software does anything with that information. Primarily, the difference between a public ID and a private ID is a private ID is a unique identifier for not only one individual, but in many cases, one individual with one of his radios. There are people out there with DMR IDs for every radio that they own, unfortunately. So there's a lot of confusion as far as that goes. Whereas a public ID is a talk group that expects a lot of traffic. But as I said, I think there's probably a place where that gets squeezed into the packet information. But as far as I'm aware, I don't know of anything that actually does anything useful with that information.
Okay. Thank you, Roy. I appreciate that.
You're welcome, Ken. Once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limar Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or topics that they would like to discuss tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, maybe we should go to a sort of a mailbag question. Surprisingly, I had a few people who pointed this out to me, the IEE, the Journal of Electrical Engineers. Dick used to read it and talk about it on the Technical Net. Wrote an interesting article, and it released it on its website. It's called The Uncertain Future of Ham Radio. I have placed it on my link page, so if you go to roy.ac2gs.com, you can link directly and open up that page and read it to your heart's content. But it's sort of the same stuff as usual, the lamentation that amateur radio has not the greatest of demographics. There's a small portion of adolescents. There's a smaller than we'd like group of young and middle-aged adults, and then there's us old fogies. So, you know, the problem has always been, you know, what happens as the old fogies go the way of all things? What happens to the hobby, and how will it survive, and will it survive? So that's the basis for this interesting article, The Uncertain Future of Ham Radio. I'd be interested in knowing people's opinion. I have loads of opinions. I'm sure a lot of people have loads of opinions. So please, If you have any ideas of whether we should all be optimistic or pessimistic or somewhere in the middle, give me your call sign and your name.
WA2VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Well, I think the very fact that these questions, for example, on DMR that are coming up shows that, you know, there is interest in these modern digital technologies, which is things that are expanding and flourishing. So in that sense, I don't agree too much with the lamentation that AM radio is disappearing. I think the fact that you have interest in these digital technologies shows that there is growth or growth potential. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I think that the hobby as a practice in real time is still going strong. We did not have as many licensed amateur radio operators, to my knowledge, as we do now. 750,000 people have a license. Most of them have technician's license, but still, that's a large number. And although the article laments the fragmentation of amateur radio, I think the fragmentation existed almost from the very beginning. There were people into CW. There were people into phone. Later, it kind of branched off. The CW people, some of them got interested into RTTY and digital transmissions, and the AM phone guys got into single sideband and FM, and that split off into digital audio. And I don't know if I would actually call it just fractured as opposed to divergent. I think one of the beauties of this hobby is the depth and breadth of the hobby that you can, you know, if you don't like one or two or 20 or 40 different sub-portions of the hobby, you can always find others out there that might interest you. So I think that that's a good point for the present, but the problem is the future. They look at the demographics, and if you've ever seen convention footage, if you've seen hamvention footage next to, say, a Comic-Con footage, you notice a significant shift in the demographics.
Associates?
Yes, Wesley.
Wondering, is there any statistic in ARL or any other organizations or anywhere based on yearly basis, how many hams are left, active, whatever?
Well, I mean, the problem is in your definition of active. The only real thing that they could easily do is just pull the database from the FCC, and they can tell you how many people presently are licensed to operate amateur radio equipment, and that's, again, somewhere around 750,000 people. They can also turn around and tell you that I think ARRL membership itself is at something like 120,000 last time I looked. But as far as active amateurs, it becomes problematic. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, you can do a statistical analysis, I guess, and it might be useful, but it might not be. And then, you know, what's active? Is active being on three different bands every day of your life? Is active being on one band twice a week? Is active being on one band every other month? You know, that's a slippery slope as well. So I think that we know the club, we know organization membership numbers, we know FCC license numbers. The rest of it is kind of amorphous.
So I understand, but that what you said, that you are pessimistic and you should call yourself dying out dinosaurs still in here with the rest of the dinosaurs listening around, including me, and Georgia.
I'm just playing the devil's advocate here. I just want to engender a conversation among my fellow hams and hopefully learn something from their wisdom and hopefully share my views to them. I am not 100% pessimistic. I tend to take a kind of different approach entirely. I think that amateur radio, if it persists, will morph into something that isn't quite obvious to us as being amateur radio. I'm sure you've bumped into people with clipboards who have a checklist and will tell you within 10 seconds whether what you're interested in is really amateur radio or something that isn't amateur radio. I think those guys with their clipboards are going to be, you know, not the final word. And, you know, what cognitive radio, and there are other technologies that are being worked on that I think will revolutionize the whole concept of the hobby. It's the same as, you know, if you talk to guys back in the old days who had spark gap transmitters and detectors with metal filings. And you told them that this was going to be gone in about 10, 20 years. They would be aghast. But I think we have a lot better stuff than those decoherers and those spark gap transmitters. They're certainly healthier and they're easier on the ears. BDH with a comment?
One more thing.
Yes, Wesley first and then John.
Let me put it this way. I'm going to try to be as nice as possible. When I was 9 years old, at that time, ham radio operators, especially in Europe, especially in Eastern Europe, were building SSB, single sideband transmitters, transceivers. They were good in their trunks whatsoever. But in the United States, soon they had access to a mate for them, transceivers, and they learn only about antennas. So with the 100% of ham radio operators, we have probably 10% of the people who are kind of fluent with electronics, and we have probably 1% of the people like Dick and you. I might be wrong. And to actually.
Well, I mean, there's no way to tell the percentages. The FCC and places like the ARRL sort of decided that numbers were much more important than limitations, and they've repeatedly taken limitations off of the exam. You talk to some of the guys back in the old good old days, and you would have to kind of mosey up to the FCC building. None of this remote stuff. And they would give you a piece of paper, and they would say, okay, draw a Colpitts oscillator and write down the values for all the components. Then they expected you to actually do that. Now they give you multiple choice questions, and they publish the multiple choice questions, and if you are so inclined to memorize all the multiple choice questions, you can pass the exam because they don't want to limit people getting into the hobby. Now, you're going to get a certain percentage of technically inclined people who will tinker, and they do great things. They work on microwaves. They work on software-defined radios. Rich W2BZ mentioned a gentleman who's tweaking firmware for a Chinese radio that uses a very generic radio-in-a-chip chipset. So you're going to get those people, and you're going to get guys out there who think that if they can plug in a box and turn it on, they deserve a cookie. Again, that's human nature. I think we can all coexist. If you want to just be a guy who talks, that's fine. Hopefully you have something to say. If you want to be a guy who tinkers and builds and designs, that's great. We sort of depend upon that. You know, people who wrote Echolink and wrote all kinds of things that we depend upon today did it for freebies, just out of a love of the technology and to help his fellow ham.
Well, that's your opinion. My opinion is that the next 20 years and ham radio operators are gone. There will be two left. I've been in the radio for, 40 years? Whatever. Yeah, more than that. And I see only notes about funerals, not much about people coming. There's so much of entertainment to the people who don't want to use too much of the brain in this area, not trying to insult anybody. Although it might be true if I do. And to actually call.
Well, you know, Wes, I understand how you feel about it. As I mentioned, one of the problems that I have seen is the demographics is decidedly on the older population, and older populations tend to fade away, unfortunately. And so you need young people to take their place, hopefully. I think very often amateur radio seems to want to grab them in junior high school. And I sort of understand because when I was a kid, I was fascinated by the magic of radio, and it really got to me. But I think they should widen their view for 20 and 30 and 40-year-olds. I have a little bit of going on with the Kings County Radio Club. We have grown the club from about 18, 19 people when I joined. We now have about 90. And it's a nice broad range. We have retired people, but we also have 30 and 40-year-olds, and I think that's a good thing. And you do that by reaching them through modes that they interact with a great deal. You know, the Internet, not necessarily Facebook, kind of grown into something that the middle-aged women kind of gossip back and forth, which is very sexist on my part, and I please forgive me. But nevertheless.
I do thank you very much. I rest my case.
Okay, I don't think it's a fait accompli, but I think the face of amateur radio is very possibly going to change. And some guys with clipboards will say that's not ham radio. John, you wanted to say something on this.
Yeah, fine business. One thing that I have noticed, for example, the thing that most of what the public perceives about amateur radio is the DXing, you know, making a contact on the other side of the world. Very rarely will you hear mentioned in public things, for example, people like Paul Wade, W1 Gigahertz, or the things that Joe Taylor is doing, or even the things that Dick Nadel is, the research he did with antennas. The researching the technical aspects of amateur radio don't catch the spotlight. What really catches the public eye, of course, is, and sometimes draws new hams in, is the DXing, what you find on the HF bands, which is also one of the reasons why I think a lot of our UHF and VHF bands are in a bit of a jeopardy. But anyway, it's again a public perception thing. But I believe amateur radio is definitely growing. Back to net.
WV2KWC, add me to the end of the queue.
Yes, Cap.
Yeah, you reached the end. Just one comment, I guess, on what Wesley said about you know, amateur radio operators being dinosaurs. I'm not sure I agree with the pejorative use of the word. I'm thinking of I've been called a dinosaur because I am a mainframe programmer, or was before I was retired. And now there is an extreme shortage. They are looking for folks to maintain all kinds of financial systems, the networks that link toll roads and stuff. So being a dinosaur might be a good thing. Anyhow, I read the article that you were talking about on number of radio amateurs, and from what I understood, it's just that we're not growing as quickly rather than our numbers being decreasing. I've found that a lot of the younger folks in amateur radio come from the maker community, the people that want to build or create something. I spoke to one young ham, and he got into the hobby because he wanted to use higher power radios for his drone camera links,
while his friends were limited to, I don't know, 100 milliwatts or whatever it is on ISM bands, he could use a lot more power on the ham radio bands, only limited by his batteries. What I do feel the biggest threat to amateur radio is the encroachment on our frequencies. There are folks that would love to have some of our frequencies and are making us justify their use. AC2GS, WB2KWC.
Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
Let me give you an interesting example of technology. Only 4 to 6 weeks ago, my position was if it wasn't antenna to antenna, it wasn't ham radio. Period. Antenna to antenna, not ham radio. Since I got into DMR, I find it in a way so fascinating, and I've had so many, let's say, drawn out or longer QSOs than I've had on, you know, local repeaters, and very enjoyable QSOs all over the world, greatly. That's number one. Number two, we're talking about that quite frankly sucks. Number three, if you talk to the Eastern Europeans and Europeans, they're much more into ham radio as it was 20 years ago. At least it's my opinion that they're more into building their own stuff and fixing their own stuff. And I think as more and more of those guys come online, there'll be a shift worldwide in ham radio, in ham radio usage. But propagation ain't the greatest. In fact, I don't remember in my 61 years of being a ham radio operator, propagation, this being that bad. And that's why I suffered with DMR, but I'm glad I have. Back to Ned.
Okay, very good, Rich. And for Ken, I don't think anyone should take the term dinosaur to heart too much. I know that Hal and a group used to have, they probably still have a net over at 145.00, an AM net called the Dinosaur Net. And you gotta keep in mind that basically all the birds that we see in the air, the chickens that we eat, are just basically the descendants of those ancient dinosaurs. So I'm just suggesting that perhaps they will not be easily recognizable to us as amateur radio operators. I'm optimistic that they will have the same curiosity and tinker nature that some of our greater hams have shown.
Everybody's still in frames. I'd sell that stock real quick.
What stock would that be?
Whatever company is using that technology still.
Well, you know, like most things, some things go on for a long, long time. You know, as much as I love software-defined radio, there's going to be people out there who are going to want to have analog radios for a long list of reasons. And, you know, again, if they don't ask me to pay for it, I have no particular problem. There's a lot of legacy technology out there, and the trouble is it's difficult to find people to maintain it because it doesn't pay profitably. As less and less people use it, you need less and less people to take care of it, and usually they're geographically not well located, and so they retire, and other people don't take their place because the demand isn't quite as much. So yeah, there are people who need COBOL and Fortran programmers to fix old stuff, and there are people who need technicians who know how to fix old stuff that no one would buy new anymore. That's just part of the nature of our technological world.
Enterprise.
Yes, Wesley.
How about if I bring that conversation to the next level, more wide, communities and population that is made out of communities is turning up to consumers. Push the button. That's all. Which is convenient. What else do they know? Am I wrong?
Well, generally speaking, the present time is a disposable time. We have gotten to the point where you can manufacture a usable item inexpensively that will break down relatively soon, but most people, all things being equal, would rather pay less even if it doesn't last longer, because the next model might be shinier or use a blue light instead of a